From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. On this edition of Fresh Air, Holly Neer tells us about her evolution as a folk singer, actress, and political activist. Also today, animator Paul Feerlinger tells us about And Then I'll Stop, his animated documentary on alcoholism, his own. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a couple of new albums from singers influenced by country music, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Kate Simon's final memoir. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. United Nations Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar met today in Jordan with the Iraqi foreign minister in an effort to reach a peaceful settlement of the crisis in the Gulf. After the opening round today, Perez said the discussions were useful and important, and a second round is planned for tomorrow. More from NPR's Tom Gelton in Amman, Jordan.
The talks between the Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz and the UN Secretary General constitute the only diplomatic initiative in the Gulf region given any chance of success. Jordan's King Hussein is on a tour of European capitals promoting the idea of a negotiated settlement of the Gulf crisis, and the Palestine Liberation Organization has its own plan for ending the conflict, but neither of those efforts is drawing attention. Both the U.S. and Iraqi governments, meanwhile, have declared their support for Perez de Cuellar's effort. But the session got off to a slow start. Tariq Aziz said after today's meeting that the Gulf crisis can only be settled through an Arab solution. Neither he nor Perez de Cuellar suggested that the difference between their viewpoints had been reconciled in any way. They said only they would meet again and hear each other out. I'm Tom Gelton in Amman.
The White House denied reports today that the administration has come under increasing pressure for direct military action in the Persian Gulf. The report said that the push for military action was coming from sources inside and outside the government who doubt the long-term effectiveness of the UN sanctions against Iraq. Speaking on condition of anonymity, administration officials with the president in Maine are reported to have said the pressure for military action was coming from some allies and from some members of Congress. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has promised consumers a six-month stabilization period before sweeping changes are implemented to move the Soviet Union to a market economy. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Gorbachev spent the last 2 days meeting with top advisors to consider draft plans for market economy. Tonight he told reporters that a final plan should be ready in a week for presentation to the Supreme Soviet, the National Legislature, and to the legislatures in the 15 Soviet republics. He said the plan will combine proposals from the Soviet government with those of a special commission set up by Gorbachev and Russian President Boris Yeltsin. The decision to draft a compromise plan could be risky. If the plan is too cautious, Gorbachev risks losing the support of those who want a rapid transition to private property, free pricing, and financial reform. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The stock market gained ground today in slow pre-holiday trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 21 points to close at 2,614.36. Volume was 97 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. As the feminist movement took off in the 1970s, a woman's music scene developed along with it. And from the beginning, at the center of that scene, has been my guest today, Holly Neer. Neer began her career in show business as a child. She appeared in plays, movies, and on TV throughout her teens. In the early 70s, she went to Vietnam with Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland as part of a Free the Army show that opposed the war. Since then, politics have guided her career. Holly Neer writes songs about causes such as lesbian feminism, the environment, and foreign policy. She founded her own independent record label, Redwood Records, that has recorded the music of many other feminist singers. Her concerts have included musicians from third world countries and a sign language interpreter for the deaf. In the mid-70s, Neer created a controversy by putting on women-only concerts, which men were not allowed to attend. Holly Neer has a new album called Singer in the Storm. and she's written an autobiography called Fire in the Rain, Singer in the Storm. Over the past two decades, Nir has been active in so many causes that she overextended herself. In 1984, she realized her body was telling her she had to slow down.
And I used to have these dreams sometimes that I was in a wheelchair. And I think when I think back on that, I think that was the only way I felt I could have explained slowing down, was that if I was completely unable to be racing at full tilt. And obviously people who are disabled in our wheelchairs don't sit around resting. It's probably the hardest work in the world to travel around this very inaccessible world. But symbolically, I think these dreams were about, won't something come along and give me permission that if I were disabled, people wouldn't expect me to be out running the 440. And it was a very strange dream to be having on a regular basis over and over again. But in fact, what happened was that I did become disabled. My back went completely dysfunctional. I lost feeling in my right leg, which is still gone. That's there, will always be there as a reminder to me that I must not ever let this happen again.
Let me ask you about the cover photo on your album, Singer in the Storm. It's a glamorous Holly Nir, is it not? I can see the airbrushes at work.
Do you know what's funny? That's when the picture came out, I was so astounded because it looks like it's been airbrushed. Do you know that whole photo was done without any touch-ups, all with lighting. This photographer she's like a painter in the way she does photography. And when I was looking at the original photos, I just thought they were so beautiful because they were like paintings. When it's put down, narrowed down onto a CD box, it really does look like a glamour shot. And I sort of think, this is the chanteuse I might have been had I followed the path of Judy Garland, you know. And there is a part of me that is that person. Mm-hmm.
Who wants to be glamorous feels glamorous?
Or at least in the when I was doing that picture, I wasn't thinking glamour. It was like I was looking, it's a very pensive shot. In fact, my mother says that there's a lot of shots of me when I was a child that looks just like that. I didn't have all the hair, but that kind of looking off into the distance, a wondering. And that's kind of what I see when I see the picture. But people who don't know me, I think, will see the glamour shot. And that's okay because it's so different than the cover of the book. The book is this, like, wholesome farm girl looking right out into the...
Farm shirt on.
Yeah, and I'm a Gemini, so maybe these are the two faces of Holly here. But I really would have liked to have been a chanteuse. If I could pick an era that I was going to sing in, it would have been the 30s and 40s. I mean, that's really a time that I feel the most comfortable. Is that era?
We don't quite fit the molds that we have created, and I think it's hard to be a folk singer without a guitar.
I know. People who have promoted my concerts and have done sound for me ask me where my guitar is.
Yeah.
I said, I don't play the guitar. And they said, yes, you do. We saw you last year. It's this extraordinary myth about folk singers, if not a guitar, at least an auto harp.
And a pair of dungarees.
That's right. And very long hair and singing 4,000 verses about fuel rods. But I don't do that. And so it really is more like a cabaret show. People who come to the concert expecting a folk singer go, oh, my goodness, you know, this is very dramatic. This is Brechtian in some ways. But someone said to me the other day, and I love this analogy, they said, Holly Nir is when Pete Seeger meets Judy Garland. And I thought, oh, thank you very much. I love that. Those are two of my favorite people in the world. And if that's the coming together in my music, I certainly am happy about that.
You were discovered, quote-unquote, at the age of 7, I believe, at a VFW
You've read
concert.
The book.
I did read the book.
Oh, sweet.
But I was wondering what you were singing, what that experience is of being discovered, especially as such a youngster.
It was a hoot, especially by the veterans of foreign war, given where I ended up later.
Do they know what they hath wrought?
Don't know. I should go back and find out. My older sister was going to dance at this competition, and she was a wonderful dancer. And I said to Mom at 7, I want to dance also. And my mother was aware of the fact that I had no plans of choreographing a dance. I was just going to put on a record, walk on stage, and improvise. And she was afraid grown-ups would laugh, and they would. I mean, they would have thought it was cute, and they would have laughed. But I wouldn't have known they were laughing because I was cute. I would have. She was afraid it would somehow destroy that spontaneity and creativity that I was so innocent. So she said, well, why don't you sing?
And she knew you could sing.
Yeah, I'd been singing around the house. And she figured I could get from one end of a song to the other with a little bit more order than just going out and racing around on stage dancing. I mean, you've seen little kids, they put on records and they just dance about, you know, but you can't sort of take
in their
that
own world.
In their own little world. Yeah. So I sang "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Had long braids down my back, blue jeans, a little work shirt, and walked out there a cappella. And when the show actually came around, I was, they, for some reason, I guess the people planning it didn't know about children, and it didn't put me on till 10 o'clock. And I apparently fell asleep on a gunny sack in the backstage, and some, you know, probably missed somebody running around with a clipboard came and woke me up and said, you're on. And I walked out and sang "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning" and went back to sleep. But I won a prize, and the biggest prize, of course, was a music teacher who was there who said to me, I think you have a lot of potential, and said to my parents, I'd like to work with your daughter.
Were you nervous?
No.
Do you remember being nervous about performing at all?
Not then. A little bit later, when I began to understand that I was performing, then I developed nerves. At that time, I didn't know I was performing. I was just singing. And that, around our house, was a completely natural thing. So later on, when I started working with a teacher, and then I did a performance where I very conscientiously began to choreograph my body for the song, because, again, I didn't always have that instrument in front of me. It was just me out there naked with the audience. So I had to learn what to do with my hands and what to do with my feet and how to physically express the emotion of a song. And I remember singing for the Grange Hall. I don't think you sing for the hall. What is it? Grangers, you know.
People in the hall.
In the gray, right. And I had at home did this wonderful choreography for I've Got a Crow from Peter Pan. And I had all racing around the stage and pointing out the shadow and all the stuff. And I began the song, and I didn't move. About halfway through, I pointed to my toe when it said the shadow to the tip of my toe, and that was it. My mother was just, oh, my poor dear, because she'd seen how much work I had done, and I had just frozen. But that experience was really important. You have to get worse before you get better if you're going to be a conscientious artist. If you're just going to always count on spontaneity working, you know, then good luck. But if you're actually going to be a working artist, you can't always count on being in a good mood. You can't always count on being calm. You can't always count on the audience being encouraging. So you have to develop skills. And that was the beginning of that skill development.
You describe yourself, and this is yourself as a young person, as an exceptional child in a small farm town. Mm. Was it then your job as a young kid to try to be normal, to be unexceptional?
Well, it always confused me that it seemed to me I was thinking about all kinds of things my friends weren't thinking about. And I got very good grades, and I remember overhearing a conversation I wasn't supposed to hear between the teacher and my parents about my high IQ and the fact that I was starting to get bored in class and become a disruption because I didn't have anything to do. And so the teacher would send me out into the park bench with a little child who had Down syndrome and had me teach her the alphabet and the numbers. And I would have performances oftentimes in the afternoon around the county, and my mom would come pick me up. And I just couldn't bear the kids saying, oh, Holly thinks she's smart.
Because did they say that?
Yeah. They were feeling, I think, insecure that I was getting all these treats, they saw them in them. I was getting to go out and teach the little girl this, and I was getting to go do shows, and I was getting to go work with the principal to reorganize the library carding system. And I was constantly getting treats. And they, at that age, didn't understand that it was a teacher trying to keep me out of her hair and keep this child busy. But it looked like privileges to them, and it was, I guess. And I didn't want that separation from my friends. I wanted so much to be accepted by them. So I would tell them that I was going to the dentist or something when my mom would come pick me up, because I just couldn't bear that sense that they would envy me. I would rather have them feel empathy. Oh, poor Hall, she has to go to the dentist, you know.
And something that everyone has to do, and everyone dreads.
And later on, when I had an opportunity to go to Hollywood, and I had an audition with Columbia Records that Johnny Mathis set up for me because my teacher had been his teacher. I couldn't bear it. It was a grueling couple of weeks trying to decide what to do about it. And I just decided, no, I want to stay. I want to grow up normal. I want to play tetherball with my friends. Of course, everybody laughs at me now at the thought I thought I was going to grow up normal given the life I have now.
We'll talk about that later.
But I just really couldn't bear that isolation of specialness.
Singer-songwriter Holly Near is my guest today on Fresh Air. She's just written her first book. It's called Fire in the Rain, Singer in the Storm, and it's about her musical career, which began back in the 1960s. She also has a new album called Singer in the Storm. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking today with singer-songwriter Holly Near. It seems, in reading your book, that you flowed easily from, here you were discovered at this young age and had this chance to sing at a young age, and then you went to UCLA and you were in the theater there. And then
you're not going
to
mention I was a football princess?
And then you went to Hollywood and you got into movies, and as you wrote about it, it seemed so easy. As if doors were kind of open for you. Was it?
Well, it was surprising. It was, and maybe it was because I didn't get desperate about it. I think when you walk into an audition in Hollywood, if you're hungry, it shows.
Yes.
And it affects your performance. And because when I went to Los Angeles, my plan was to go to New York to work on being a Broadway artist. I had no desire to be a film and television actress. So when they first came to a show I did at UCLA and these agents were all throwing their cards at me and everything, I said, well, thanks very much, but I'm not interested. And then later,
makes them hungrier, doesn't it?
Yeah, then they all of a sudden, they couldn't bear that thought, right? So they kept calling. And it wasn't tactical on my part, but it just, that's what happened. And I finally got a call from an agent who said, you sure you haven't changed your mind? And I was broke. I didn't have a penny, and I was about to start working in the administration's office at UCLA. And I said, well, how much will they pay me? And I got this part. I did this part really because I needed money.
And the part was in something called Angel, Angel, Down We Go.
Down We Go with Jennifer Jones. And they piled all these black wigs on my head because I had to be a brunette. And there off I went. It was with Roddy McDowell, who was a sweet, dear man. And Lou Rawls was in it and Charles Aidman. And it was a terrible film. It was supposed to be Jennifer's comeback, and I don't think she ever worked again after that. It was just awful. One of those films that, you know, goes to direct to drive-in.
It would be video today. But
oh,
I didn't
hope
exist.
They don't make a video out of it. It's just awful. But it gave me a taste of what it was I had been rejecting, mm-hmm. and I fell in love with the medium of film. I thought it was wonderful. And so then I really did start wanting to work. But at the time, I was quite plump, and I was not an ingenue. I was a character actress, and there were not very many young girls in Hollywood who weren't skinny. So me and Kathy Burns, who was the other plump actress, teenage actress, got all the parts. And it was a perfect time. Now there's a lot more young character actresses out there since Hairspray and all these different films. But then there was really two or three of us, and it gave me an opportunity to work a lot.
You write about doing your first sex scene and the difficulty, I guess, of being yourself kind of sexually uninitiated and having to really pretend through this whole experience while 9 people are watching you. And I guess
so
learning to fake an orgasm. You said you had to anyway. You didn't know what one was at that point.
Well, it was, you know, on the movie sets, there's so many people standing around working. I mean, they all have jobs. But fortunately, the leading actor, Jordan Christopher, was more experienced than I was. And when we came down to the set to do this, I can't really call it a lovemaking scene because it was a little more vicious than that. But he took my hand and said, no, we're not doing this till they clear the set, except for the necessary people. So I thought, great, we'll be down to the camera person and the director. We came back and there were 9 necessary people there. But we did this scene, and I was just holding on by the skin of my teeth. I didn't have the slightest idea what I was doing, and I didn't trust anybody on the set to ask. I didn't know what was happening, and it was sort of scary.
Have you... I mean, you must have seen the
scene. I've learned what to do since
then. Well, I know that wasn't my question. Did you, though, when you look back at the movie, did you look convincing?
I think so. I think you're a good actress. And the thing about that, I mean, I don't know how risque we want this conversation to get, but there's a whole lot of different ways to make love. So it turned out that it didn't quite matter what you did. It was all right.
You said, though, you spent a lot of years looking for that right part. I mean, that and wasn't, I don't think, just your weight that kept you out. But I guess, I mean, Hollywood makes decisions about people and kind of puts them into slots and then keeps them there.
They also make a lot of bad movies. Yeah. I mean, the odds are not very good in Hollywood for making a good film.
Yeah.
So I was in a lot of what started out to look like interesting pictures but ended up being grade B movies. And I kept getting very nice reviews in them. But they kept getting voted 10 best worst picture of the year. And I said, I would like to get a bad review in a good film now. This would be more fun. But it was a good training ground. Mm-hmm. And then finally Slaughterhouse-Five came along. And that was a wonderful film and a great opportunity. And then I got to work in a mini in Moskowitz, which was directed by John Cassavetes. And although my part is very small in that, I spent the whole day working with him and actor Seymour Cassells. And that was like having been in an acting class for 10 years. In one day, he taught me so much. It was a great gift.
Part of your book and part, I guess, of your life has been a quest to sort of figure out your sexual identity. And I think in this country we're guilty of trying to put people, again, into these small boxes and say you are homosexual, you're heterosexual, you're bisexual. And you seem to have come up with a kind of a definition for yourself which seems very unique in a kind of way. And you call yourself a lesbian, but you say that it's more than a sexual preference. It's a worldview. Mm. And I'm interested in what you mean by that.
Well, it's hard. And even, you know, I keep learning, even having written the book. I think now it's very hard for me to fairly call myself a lesbian if there are women out there who don't think you should call yourself a lesbian if you have relationships with men. We have a language that is fairly underdeveloped to discuss these things, and we need to find words for it. I have had relationships with both men and women, and people say, well, isn't that bisexual?
Yeah.
But the problem with that word, and I don't mind other people calling themselves that, but for me, it lacks a kind of public identity with lesbian feminism and creates an invisibility for lesbians that I don't really want to participate in. And it almost sounds like, well, yeah, I've had relationships with women, but I want to make sure you know I'm also sort of straight so that I can have the safety of heterosexual privilege. And I never wanted to be one of those women who went on national television saying, well, yeah, I had relationships with women, but now I'm married and have kids, and that was just a phase, and I don't want to be associated with that. Because I'm not the least bit wanting to distance myself from lesbian feminism as a political view.
Do you see, though, lesbian feminism is different from, we'll say, heterosexual feminism? I mean, do you make a distinction?
If women have chosen to be heterosexuals because that is really their preference, then I totally value that. I don't have any need for us to be something sexually that we're not. What is exciting to me is when there are heterosexual women who also do not separate themselves from lesbians and can go out with the gals for the night and not have to say, oh, but I'm straight, uh-huh. Can go to a gay rights march and not have to carry a banner that makes sure everybody knows that they're straight, that we stop having negative feelings about what it is to be gay. Because gay people all the time are going out with straight people and, you know, coexisting with that culture. We go to movies and fall in love with heterosexual men and women on the screen, and we don't ask them to necessarily change their identity. We can relate in and out of these different sexual modes, where straight people have such a need to constantly reassure themselves that they're straight and that they're safe and that everything's all right. And they'll say, oh, well, I have gay friends, mm-hmm. in that kind of way. But there's always this safety distance in there.
What I found interesting, and this was actually having a number of relationships with men, that the first time you made love with a woman, you said that you felt like you came out to yourself.
Mm.
And then it was, I guess, the first time that you felt integrated, I suppose, mm-hmm. in this particular act or relationship.
Well, I wouldn't say that I could speak for all women, but I know from a lot of women I've talked to that we don't always feel very confident about our sexuality when we start out having relationships with men, that there is this feeling that our bellies aren't flat enough and our hips are too big and the smells of our bodies are strange, and then they're selling all these products out there to try to tell us to change how we are. And when you fall in love with a woman, you discover that all these judgments that you thought were being made against you were ridiculous, that bodies are beautiful, that our bodies are extraordinarily beautiful, and that when you fall in love with your own body, which is what happens when you fall in love with another woman, there's this self-appreciation. It's like this huge rock being taken off your shoulder where you can just say, ugh. And then if you choose to be with men, then you can start to say, I want to be with a man who loves women, because I now know what it feels like to love women. I don't have to accommodate his misogyny anymore. I don't have to be different than who I am in order to have him love me. I know now that women are lovable as we are. And if I'm going to be with a man, I will be with a man who loves women.
So making love with a woman is, in a sense, also making love with oneself.
Mm-hmm. And it's very liberating. And
see, some people would say that's narcissistic.
I don't know whether that's a bad
word
or not. I think falling in love with oneself, regardless of what the name is what a delightful gift. How terrible to go through life not loving oneself, the person you have the most intimate relationship with throughout your life. And how can you offer yourself to someone else if you don't love yourself? What you're really doing is offering them a fantasy, or you're offering them a myth or a lie. And then you spend the rest of your life trying to keep that lie together. But when you really love yourself, you're just out there, this is who I am. And if you don't like it, go away, because I like it. And there's this whole new kind of energy and self-esteem that enters in. And then, of course, if a woman decides to stay with women and that she really does love women and she's a lesbian, then there's a whole other series of things that she has to deal with, and that is being in a society that is endlessly critical, and it's dangerous. You can have your children taken away from you. You can lose your job. You can be disowned from your families. You can get involved in a kind of running away and creating little harbor circles around where you get alienated from society at large, because society at large is so cruel. And when you do that, then it causes all kinds of internal problems within one's community.
It's interesting the way you talk about yourself and the way that your music doesn't quite fit all these kinds of categories, that you've really borrowed and taken from lots of different influences and sources and somehow kind of put yourself together. Are you happy with what you did? I know we don't have any choice in this matter usually.
Well, I keep stretching. You know, I see this image of a dancer, and I look at somebody like Baryshnikov, and I know that he didn't get to that state of greatness by sitting around. And if you want to become a human being, reach human potential in the way an athlete becomes the best runner, a dancer becomes the best dancer, you have to work out all the time. You have to get your brain and your heart and functioning like an amazing muscle and a coordination. And I'm not at the end of that yet. I like what I've done so far, but there's still some places where I just chase my tail and go around in circles, and I seek help in those areas, to talk to teachers, to look at it and look at it again and look at it again. But I do think by the time I get to the end of the journey, at least I'll be an example, a series of trials and errors that people can study, if nothing else, and say, well, let's take this and discard that.
Great. Well, thank you, Holly Neer, for joining us today.
This was fun.
Good.
I had a good time. I hope your listeners had a good time.
I'm sure they did. Thanks. My guest today was singer-songwriter Holly Neer. She's just written her autobiography called Fire in the Rain, Singer in the Storm. She's also got a new album called Singer in the Storm. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Love flies free from the prison bars and lights the candles with the stars and carries news home from afar. She's a singer in the storm. She's a singer in the storm.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. When animator Paul Feerlinger started work on his documentary about alcoholism, he was a bottle-a-day drinker. He's since kicked his habit, and his film, titled And Then I'll Stop, has become a critical success. Coming up, we talk with Paul Feerlinger about his recovery and his work. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from Carlene Carter and Kelly Willis, two women who draw from country influences. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Etchings in an Hourglass, the final memoir by Kate Simon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Iraq Today requested that planes carrying Westerners to London and Paris return with Iraqis on board. NPR's Brian Naylor has more from London.
It was, said Iraqi spokesman Naji Al-Hadithi, a humanitarian request. He said there were Iraqis stranded in Britain and France without access to their bank accounts because of what he called the brutal American sanctions. Al-Hadithi asked that Iraq Air flights carrying Westerners out of Baghdad return with the stranded Iraqis on board. The British Foreign Office said that would be no problem, that any Iraqi in Britain would be free to go. France is said to be holding some 26 Iraqi nationals under house arrest who are military personnel or who have access to defense secrets. There was no official word from Paris on whether the French government would meet the Iraqi request. Baghdad says more than 200 Westerners are waiting to leave for London and Paris. That number includes 14 Americans out of 1,000 U.S. women and children in Iraq and Kuwait. This is Brian Naylor in London.
President Bush called on key U.S. allies today to help finance military deployments in the Persian Gulf and the international embargo of Iraq. President Bush telephoned the leaders of Britain, France, and Saudi Arabia about what he called burden-sharing in the crisis. The administration is sending Secretary of State James Baker to Europe and the Middle East and Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady to Asia to speak to government officials there about the cost of the Gulf operation. After more than 5 hours of talks today on the Persian Gulf situation, U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz agreed to talk again tomorrow. Perez tried to downplay expectations of a breakthrough, calling the meetings an exchange of views, not negotiations. Hundreds of students from the University of Florida have fled Gainesville following this week's murder of 5 college students. Lisa Barr of member station WUFT reports those remaining hope the 100 officers and team of experts on the case will find the killer.
According to the Orlando Sun-Sentinel, a suspect is being held on $1 million bond, something that's making those still in Gainesville breathe a bit more easier, and that has police concerned. They say the killer or killers could still be in the Gainesville area, and they don't want people to relax just yet. There's been lots of printed and broadcast news reports about links between one of 4 named suspects and the murder victims, but task force spokespersons are adamant the news media should not be naming names or going into any specifics. Earlier this week, details about victim mutilation were released despite the pleas of police. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Barr in Gainesville, Florida.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 21 points to 2614.36. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in light trading of some 97 million shares. This is National Public Radio News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new memoir by the late writer Kate Simon. But first, rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of new albums by Carlene Carter and Kelly Willis. Both are singers with rock and roll sensibilities who are making country music.
Throughout her career, Carlene Carter has had a music business advantage that she's chosen to wear like a millstone around her neck. She's part of the Carter family, a legendary clan in country music. Her great-grandfather was A.P. Carter, one of country music's pioneers. Carlene's grandmother was Maybelle Carter, the groundbreaking auto harpist and singer. Her mother is June Carter, the singer married to Johnny Cash. Her father is Carl Smith, a great honky-tonk singer. The song that started this review, You're the One, was a top 10 hit for Smith the week that Carlene was born in 1956. With all of this country music history behind her, you'd think Carlene Carter's own success would have been assured. Instead, she's just now in her mid-30s, and after more than 15 years as a professional, enjoying her first hit single. As I said, I Fell in Love is Carlene Carter's first country hit. Of course, it's also the first country single she's ever released. Carter spent her youth rebelling against her heritage, trying to be a rock star. She recorded a string of often quite good but commercially unsuccessful rock albums. In the late 70s, she married the English rocker Nick Lowe and hung around Britain writing songs with the Nick Lowe, Dave Edmonds, Elvis Costello crowd. Much of that influence can still be heard in her music, such as on this one, One Love. In the mid-80s, Carter's rock career was going nowhere, so she spent 2 years touring with the Carter family, an ongoing concern that includes a number of Carlene's aunts in their 60s as well as her mother. The experience, she claims, sparked a real interest in country music for the first time. Like a lot of rebellious baby boomers, she settled down and became what she used to scorn. In contrast to this artful flip-flopping, there's Kelly Willis. She's a rock generation woman in her early 20s who's always evinced an interest in pure country.
Well, I took those vows to prove my love was strong. And you told me that our love was carved in stone. Well, that stone's crushed today and the pieces blown away. But you swore to me that nothing could go wrong. Our love's turned into something to keep us from being alone. Cause I don't miss you when you're not here. I'm just lonely.
Where Carlene Carter uses her sharp, poignantly thin voice to convey urgency and passion, Kelly Willis uses her rich, strong voice to communicate wryness and regret. It's an approach that's earned her many comparisons to country music great Patsy Cline. One of the best songs on her debut album is a recently written one, but she makes it sound like a classic old Patsy Cline hit. This is I Don't Want to Love You, But I Do.
When you took me to that place where
there are also times when Willis sounds like Linda Ronstadt when Ronstadt was just starting out. There's a throatiness in Willis's voice that reminds me of Ronstadt at her best, which is to say before she became mannered and self-conscious.
Don't understand why I don't love you. No one could ask for a heart more true. Sometimes I think I was born this blue. I should have known.
Both Carlene Carter and Kelly Willis have a certain callowness in their music. In Carter's case, it sounds like lingering ambivalence about giving herself over to country. In Willis's case, this might be the sound of a young singer discovering the full power of her voice. In both cases, the results are uneven, but very satisfying.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. That's Kelly Willis, and this is Fresh Air. In Paul Feerlinger's animated documentary, And Then I'll Stop, you hear the voices of alcoholics coming face to face with their own addictions. One of the voices you hear is Feerlinger's own. The film is the first animated documentary to take on the subject of alcoholism. Before this film, most of Feerlinger's work had been industrial shorts for businesses and associations. When I spoke with him, I wanted to know why he wanted to make a film about alcoholism. He told me the idea wasn't his. Rather, he was approached by his distributor, Pyramid Films.
They challenged me to make a film on substance abuse. And they didn't know it, but at that time I was a bottle-a-day drinker.
Now, did you know that you were an alcoholic at
the
time?
Oh, sure. I called myself at that time, bravely, a functioning alcoholic.
And how well did you function?
I thought I did all right. I functioned so that I made money. That's as far as I functioned. And I took on the film, and the way I approached it was I asked a friend of mine who was who's a counselor in a rehab to interview people in various stages of recovery. And so I had something like 25 hours of tapes of various people from young to old and men and women and poor and rich, and listening to them, I recognized myself in every one of those stories. So at that point, I decided that I have to quit.
I noticed in the documentary that when you drew alcoholism, the lines were jaggedy and
were
the colors were dark. But when you have the picture, for instance, of recovery and of an AA meeting, they're soft colors. The shapes are round. There's a kind of warmth to it that you don't see in the mm-hmm. alcoholic part.
That's wonderful that you noticed that. You're the first one. No one has really told that. And it was an intention. I had intended to do it rough, black and white in the beginning, and as the stories progress, then bring in more color, and so that it won't be a preachy film. So the viewer will get the feeling of feeling better along with the people in recovery, without being told that now they are better people or feeling better people.
Well, did you feel that sort of dark, jaggedy line when you were an alcoholic?
Well, when I started the film, then I was heavily into my addiction. The thing is, I had to throw out about 5 minutes, the first 5 minutes of the film, and start all over again. So what you see in that film was all done sober.
Hmm.
But the feelings were still there.
Was it hard to work sober? Hard to get used to working sober.
It was in the beginning because I drank at work. I started in the morning and I had a glass next to me all day long and all night.
So you just nursed this glass along?
I just sort of sipped all day long. I never got into falling down the steps or anything like that. But I was just soaked all day long. So that was strange in the beginning, and I learned all sorts of things like how to make proper tea the proper way and spend time making it.
And is that something that almost, it keeps your hands busy?
Yep. Yeah.
You say in this film that the only feeling that you knew was anger.
Was anger. Yeah, I had anger is a is a terrible part of addiction. And it's something that people around me, my family thought, they really thought that I have a brain tumor.
Because of your irrational behavior?
Yeah, because of my behavior. And they were so used to me drinking all the time that no one even thought of considering that. So I knew that I had these terrible fits that just tore me inside. And I felt that there's something wrong with me. So it was real insanity, and I had no problem admitting that when I had to decide.
What other feelings, then, have you added to your repertoire of feelings since you've been sober?
See, I started drinking and almost instantly, heavily drinking, at the age of 15. And I guess my spiritual development stopped around that age, 15 to 18. So I had to learn in the past year everything that I had missed all those years.
You must be busy.
30. It's true. It's true. It's a good way of putting it.
I noticed that when you were drawing somebody, one of the people in the film's alcoholism, that they cut themselves in half. There's a scene where the head stays still and the body keeps moving. A real disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what many alcoholics talk about? That they've sort of split themselves in two?
Yeah, that's what I did in the film. I actually tried to draw something that the people were trying to say, or what I thought that they would draw if they could draw. And the scene you're mentioning is, it's a white collar type of he's a vice president in a corporation, and so everything I drew him with straight lines, so it just came out of that more than thinking of him as a how did you put it, a split personality? You didn't
well,
say that.
Well, someone sort of divided in half, disconnected.
It came more out of the lines than what you had mentioned.
Have you shown this film to other people who are alcoholics? And yes. I'm interested in what their response is to it.
For me, it's rewarding because everyone, it does what I wanted to do. Everyone finds a little bit of his story in it. And what's even more rewarding is when I show this at a festival or places like that, or even at a business meeting where I'm looking for work, let's say, and someone will come to me afterwards or catch me on the street and will want to talk to me about his addiction. Every single time it happens. So the film is really working.
Well, is there something about animation that is a kind of friendly approach to a problem? I mean, it takes some of the sting and the barbs out of it.
It's, I think, this type of animation, which is hard to describe because it is not always cartoon animation, it is not funny animation, although it has some humor in it, then I think it's an illustration of thoughts or of feelings, and people aren't used to that. They're used to talking heads and soap opera kind of dramatizations. And by now, they have those kinds of approaches have ceased to be effective because there's just too much of it. So I think it's effective because of that. And also, when you see a drawing of somebody or somebody's voice, then you don't really see nobody is telling you what the person looks like.
Somebody
is
telling you. There's a kind of anonymity.
Right, that's it. And it's telling you what the person has in his mind, not what's on his face.
I'm interested in how you begin with your drawings and whether you start with the nose, because you seem to like noses a lot.
That's incredible that you knew that.
Well, they're very not just prominent, but they just it all seems to start with the nose. Yeah,
they point
exactly.
I start with the nose, just above the ground.
Well, is that what you notice on people's faces?
Are you a particularly attracted to noses?
Yeah, the center of the face, I guess. I don't know. I think it's more... I've often questioned myself because people do notice that and they make fun of me, other artists, because not everyone starts with a nose.
Well, I half expected when I saw you today to see a big nose on your face. I don't know why. I just thought maybe you would have one.
Do I?
No. And then where do you go from there? I mean, in terms of... And the reason I ask this is that your characters are very fluid, and they have a kind of shimmering quality to them, and sometimes they turn into a squiggle, and then they turn into a note, and then they turn back into a person again. And I'm interested how you think of that.
I start with the soundtrack. Sound is very important for me. So I have a composer, a sound man, Paul Messing, who works with me every day when I work. So we work very closely. And the day I could afford to have my own sound equipment, to have my own sound studio, that day my work improved just several 100%.
Well, what are you working on now? And I don't know whether sometimes that's bad luck to talk about, but are you working on more things, for instance, in this whole addiction field that you've
done? I would like to. I would like to make a second part of this film on the spirituality of healing. And it seems to be very difficult to find a source of funds for that film because people are very scared of this subject. And I think I could handle it in a non-preachy, non-sentimental way. And that's something I would like to do very much.
Animator Paul Feerlinger, his film on alcoholism is called And Then I'll Stop. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Noah Adams has joined us. Hi, Noah.
Hello.
What do you have for us?
On our program, of course, again, the latest about the Persian Gulf reports from NPR's Tom Jelton, Brian Naylor, and John Itzty in the Persian Gulf region. Also, yesterday, I traveled out into Virginia to the town of Woodstock, a small town in Shenandoah County, Virginia, and I went to the Shenandoah County Fair to talk with people there about this issue of U.S. military involvement in the Persian Gulf. I talked with a druggist, a dry cleaner, an auto parts store owner, a cattle grower, and also several drivers taking part in a demolition derby at the county fair. Also tonight, the issue of should performers lip sync their music on stage.
Okay, Noah, thanks. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When writer Kate Simon died last February at the age of 77, she had just completed a sequel to her two earlier memoirs about growing up and coming of age in New York. Critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of Etchings in an Hourglass.
There's a sentence at the end of Etchings in an Hourglass that could serve as Kate Simon's epitaph. She writes, "At 17, I was so enamored of life, of its vagaries, its soaring flights, and precipitous depths, that I promised myself I would experience everything, stipulating no qualities, good or bad, and it has pretty much all happened." I don't think that many people at the end of their lives are able to say that it's pretty much all happened, but I would have expected nothing less from Simon. Like most of her other admirers, I came to know Simon through her two earlier memoirs. In Bronx Primitive, she depicted herself as a fearless and funny scrapper, an immigrant child who roamed through the streets and apartment houses of the Bronx that overflowed with eccentric Jewish, Italian, and Irish neighbors. Her second book, A Wider World, detailed Simon's adventures during the Depression when she catapulted herself into the more exotic realms of Hunter College and Greenwich Village. But Etchings in an Hourglass is starkly different from Simon's other autobiographical and travel writings. It describes probably the only journey that Simon was ever reluctant to make, the journey into old age and death. Simon began this last memoir when she learned that she was dying of stomach cancer. The book is a farewell to the life she lived so fully, and it's also a settling of old scores. Like I said, she was a scrapper. At first, reading Etchings in an Hourglass reminded me of watching the last minutes of that old adventure movie, She, where the beautiful young goddess ages 10 centuries in an instant. It's disorienting to suddenly come upon Simon as an old woman with brown spots on her forearms and a senior citizen transit pass. The last time I encountered Simon's autobiographical self, she was living a bohemian odyssey of free love in the village. The second disturbing revelation is that Simon endured so much tragedy in her life. Her two other memoirs told about how she triumphed over hardships like poverty and hunger. But here we learn about miseries that she couldn't escape. Her first husband, her only child, and her sister all died young of brain tumors. But despite its subject, Etchings in an Hourglass isn't a grim book. Simon writes passionately about travels in Mexico and Europe and about the bizarre characters, not unlike her early Bronx neighbors, who she meets and often sleeps with. This memoir, like the others, celebrates Simon's sexual adventures. Some are humiliating, others hilarious, like the night with the Hollywood star who only wants her to watch as he makes love to himself while seated on a giant throne. Etchings in an Hourglass is also charged with what women's writing often lacks, anger. Simon is righteously furious at her own loss of youth. She says, "I have been a pretty good, if cowardly and silent, hater, but there is nothing I loathe so much now as time, slippery, uncontrollable, irresponsible, answerable to no one and nothing, the most powerful of life's dirty tricks." When Bronx Primitive was published, lots of critics hailed it as a classic female coming-of-age story. Etchings in an Hourglass is something even rarer, an unsentimental account of old age and approaching death in which Simon, true to character till the end, rages against the dying of the light.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed Kate Simon's Etchings in an Hourglass. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a live concert with Brave Combo, the band that stretches the limits of that much maligned musical form, the polka. Also, we meet the leader of the Lounge Lizards, musician and actor, John Lurie. That and more next time on Fresh Air.
He's a young man of exceptional talent, and his style is particularly interesting because his ideas are so varied. He goes from stride into bebop and beyond, in fact, way beyond. Harry, welcome to Piano Jazz.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm glad you are here.